So you have a little bit of old Hawaii culture, you have modern Hawaii, you have family matters, and a pretty good movie. The movie also features Matthew Lillard. There are some interesting twists and turns to it. This movie essentially looks at a man and how he manages his life. Clooney puts in a good performance, but you know what? I've seen him do better. He's very casual, very calm, very good in this performance. I don't quite think it's the best performance of the year, but George Clooney is likable, and again, he's very charming on screen, and he plays a very good dad, and it shows his emotional upswings and downswings when faced with all sorts of family dilemmas, which we all go through at one time or another. The movie that's going to give The Descendants a very good run for the money for the Oscar has got to be The Artist. Imagine a silent movie being nominated for an Oscar. It won the Golden Globes for Best Comedy Musical. The Artist is a silent movie. There's no speaking words, and it's great. It's from France. It's a French gem, and it's magnifique. The movie is it's set in the days of silent pictures. It all revolves around an actor, a swashbuckling Douglas Fairbanks kind of guy, who, along with his dog, is the darling of film fans. And naturally, I think he's married in the piece. He's got a manservant played by James Cromwell from Babe fame, and that lovable, likable dog. But you know what? As time goes on, a young starlet meets him, and they begin a relationship, a romantic affair. And wouldn't you know of it, over time, this man's career begins to fade, and the starlet who he befriended and who he sort of mentored grows, and there's a switch of roles. So at the end of the movie, or near the end, this guy who was once a huge star, this figure, is reduced to essentially a poverty. So it's wonderful to see the changes in this movie, and it's wonderful to see how love can endure.
That grabs you right here, doesn't it? That's my wild child, Mr. Clarence Gatemouth Brown. I'll remember April, all the Beat Boys. Now, ladies and gentlemen, one of my favorite singers, Miss Mittie Collier.
Tired of soulless radio? Tune in to Shake a Tail Feather with yours truly, DJ Jason, for the finest in classic soul and rhythm and blues. Late 50s to the early 70s, including lesser-known artists, regional hits, lost soul gems, and contemporary artists recording in that classic soul style. Listen alternate Sundays, 3 to 5 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Podcast at CITR.ca.
Hey, Mr. Freddie King, honey, what you gonna do?
Towed out.
You towed out?
Ready.
Ain't this a shame? Go ahead.
Are you ready?
I dreamt I had to go to Mars. I'm always kidding on about going to Mars through the day. But faced with the reality of it in a dream, I was terrified. And it wasn't going to be like a moon trip. There was three of us going, but we couldn't all go in the same ship. We had to go one at a time, with a day between us. I had to go first, and it was the thought of passing through all that black space, all the darkness with nothing in it, and then being the first one to land there all alone. I knew it was supposed to be all dark around, with just a red surface. But what if I got there and it was light, all civilized and populated and stuff? So I made a plan. The other two astronauts were going to be my dad and my sister. My dad would come first after me. So I decided when I landed, I would just stay in my seat until he got there. Then we could both get out together. Have a look around and see what sort of things were there. I woke up and I was lying in the darkness, I thought I had landed, and I just lay still for a while, waiting for my dad to get there too.
Song like that in your head, I don't think there's much you can't do. 8-year-old Juliet has unleashed what could be the most hardcore track this side of the Cancer Bats. And since she's Australian, I decided to dedicate that to all the Australians out there for Australia Day tomorrow. And Belle and Sebastian before that with Little Boy Space Dream. Because today is Robbie Burns Day, and that is how much I appreciate your culture. And this, Accosting the Airwaves, is Shameless on 101.9 FM, CITR. I am Jonathan Brown here, pushing the buttons, literally and figuratively, webcasting and podcasting at CITRD.ca, and on Twitter at CITR Radio. Feel free to tweet us, and if you've got a request, I could always play for you. You could call us up on the old reliable phone lines at 822-2487. That spells UBC-CITR. On your phones. Now, I love when things come full circle, and the story of the lives of the band joining me in the studio is quite circular. They are ordinary lives, and we'll be in conversation throughout the show about the band, the music. First, though, how about some introductions?
Hi, I'm Ross.
My name's Randy.
Pleasure to have you on board today.
Thanks, John.
Yeah, right on. It's good to be here.
And we're going to get into a bunch of your tracks.
Okay.
Talk about them each in depth. First, let's start with One in a Million. What is the story behind this track?
Well, I don't know. Your basic... I was writing about some one person, but usually when I write songs, I just I come up with an idea and then sort of expand on it. But there's some other things from other people, from conversations about... like geographic relocations to escape from their trouble with a, you know, like a dysfunctional love affair. And that's kind of what the song is about. I had other people who said it was, the guy goes into a dream, and in the dream his love of his life comes into the room and all things sort of get bad. But it's kind of I'm using other people's concepts, you know, of how they deal with broken up love affairs.
You know, the most interesting thing about the song that I can think of is that it's based on a really simple guitar riff, which is used with open strings and octaves. And I have guitar students. I moonlight one afternoon, one evening a week, teaching guitar lessons. And I found that this riff that Ross came up with is really conducive to beginners, especially if you're doing the power chord for 10-year-olds sort of philosophy. Not that I completely subscribe to that philosophy all the time, but there are times when it's expedient. So not only has Ross given us a pop song that has some depth in terms of the never-ending story of rejection and love that's unattainable, he's also given a couple of days of guitar lessons.
Really?
No.
That is so interpretive. Speaking of kids, what do you think of Juliet's masterpiece?
It was fantastic.
I thought it was terrific.
It's fantastic. I think that the false harmonic string pops and her screaming were, it was synchronicity.
I agree.
Yeah, it was really good.
Nice. Well, here is One in a Million. This is you.
That's right.
Ordinary Lives.
She's on fire, she's got style. Well, there's something about her that's ever so wild. She's got change, she's got grace. She stands out in a crowd, but not out of place. Well, she's one of I'm so tired, I'm so wired, I'm going out of my mind. I think I'm gonna expire. I need sleep, I need food. I'm gonna fly to Cancun just to alter my mood. Well, she's one in a million, out of a billion girls that have passed my way. When it's time to deliver, I'm gonna give her something inside. Then a knock on the door gets me to jump through the floor. She's a society babe, and she's American babe. He quits with legs that are long, but I'm not sure if she's gone. It doesn't matter to me, cause she's my epiphany. Well, she's one in a million, out of a billion girls that have passed my way. When it's time to deliver, I'm gonna give her something inside. It's not fair, it's not right. How come she's packing her bag? She should be spending the night. I feel pain, I'm insane. From biological urges that I'm not to blame. I'm so blue, I'm so green. Well, I'm ready to yell out. I'm stuck in a dream in some chair I came to in a faraway place on. Well, she's one in a million, out of a billion girls that have passed my way. When it's time to deliver, I'm gonna give her something inside I've saved. Well, she's one in a million, out of a billion girls that have passed my way.
2011 marks the 25th anniversary of the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden since opening in 1986. The Dr. Sun Yat-sen Chinese Garden is very pleased to have been able to connect cultures and communities for the past 25 years and continue being an arts and cultural hub in the neighborhood and the city. Watch for complimentary specials on the 25th day of every month. There are also blockbuster exhibits, community events, academic conferences, and music and theater productions lined up, plus contests and giveaways. CITR 101.9 FM is proud to be a year-long partner as the Garden celebrates its 25th anniversary. For more information, visit www.vancouverchinesegarden.com.
Show your Friends of CITR card or simply mention that you heard about the garden on CITR to receive $2 off admission.
January 28th, prepare for the Triple Threat Show of the Season. Local garage rockers, the Pack AD, on tour to support their latest album, Unpersons, live at the Rickshaw Theater. with special guests, Pierced Arrows and Black Wizard. Advanced tickets are available at Neptune, Red Cat, and Zulu Records, or at liveattherickshaw.com. That's the Pack AD with special guests, Pierced Arrows and Black Wizard, live at the Rickshaw, January 28th. The Pack AD at the Rickshaw Theater is proudly sponsored by CITR.
I bought the record.
They've traveled the world on tour. Now they're back home this Saturday at the Rickshaw. Becky Black and Maya Miller are the Pack AD from their latest record, Unpersons. That was Haunt You on Shameless 101.9 FM, CITR, The Long Weekends from Halifax. Before that, with Don't Reach Out. And we started that set off with the classic, legendary, Ordinary Lies with One in a Million. Ross and Randy are here with me in the studio right now. Ordinary Lies themselves.
We're here.
We are.
We were talking. Where would those guys record those tunes that you just played? Are you aware of sort of the recording history? Like where is that stuff done now?
There's a few. The Hive is still a very popular place to record records.
Here
in Vancouver, yeah.
Right. This thing's just.
And where else? Do you know? I shouldn't be asking you questions. I'm sorry.
Everybody does it in their basement now, Randy. So
do they?
They do it in at home, they like we did.
In their living room, like
yeah,
at your house.
Like we did it.
There have been churches, there have been... I've heard stories of people using, who couldn't afford mic stands, would hang microphones out of the beams in their roof.
Really? That sounds apocryphal. I can't believe you wouldn't have a be able to get a mic stand together.
Well, I don't know.
it's organic.
My first reverb unit was two microphones at the end of the room in the basement at my mom's house.
Really?
Yeah, seriously, yeah. No, that's how I did it.
How did it work?
Yeah, Okay. I put a speaker in the middle of the room, and then because I couldn't afford a reverb unit, so I put a speaker in the middle of the room. And
do you think on Pro Tools now there's going to be a sample that says Ross's mom's basement?
Well, they could be, but
it'd be an expensive app.
It's a good thing to do. I mean, there's some great places that you can record, like the church, St. James Church, down at 10th and Trutch. It's a beautiful room if you could get in there and just record there.
There are presets on Adobe Audition, a great audio recording program, that are called Outside the Club, Lonely Karaoke Bar, Old Time Radio.
Yeah.
You can do anything.
And that's just a bunch of EQ, right?
Yeah, you just click it, boom.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, the future is now, Ross.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, like, it's hard. We're using all digital stuff. And we actually mixed in the box, as opposed to there's a bit of stuff there, but we didn't, you know, we recorded.
It's interesting, like recording in the 70s was not that hard and it sounded quite good. Then in the 80s, it got really complicated.
This is my assumption, listening to music over the years.
Yeah, the birth of the whole digital effects world, it got really, really hard to do. And then guitars and basses and drums and sounds got more sophisticated. It got really hard. Like, getting a good guitar sound in 1983 was quite complicated. You know, there were guys like Ted Templeman that were doing it with Ronnie Montrose and Eddie Van Halen, and it seemed to be really fluid, and they were able to do it really quickly. But that was not my experience. It seemed really, really hard to do. It was like you were going through a whole bunch of stuff. And then when sort of the more advanced digital domain came in and tape went away and there was none of that, then it got really easy again. So it's pretty easy now.
It's faster.
Yeah.
It's faster. I mean, all our stuff, it wasn't really that. It's just finding the right microphone.
We could have lost lots of hearing, though.
Yeah.
So I don't even know.
And also, all the vintage stuff came back. I mean, you can buy all these speakers that are like the Celestion speakers, the vintage 30s, and different speakers that sound better.
But records recorded with a couple of microphones in 1950, in 1955, sound really, really good.
Yeah.
So why is that?
I think it's because it's done live, and it's not all this nitpicking, and you can't sort of like squeeze the life out of a thing. Like, you know, it's that thing where if you can do it, why not do it? And then going, well, it was much better, you know, like it was good then. It's just the way it is. Like, you know, it'd be much nicer to go in the studio and say, we have 3 days to do this and let's go do it, rather than we have 3 months to do it. If you're going to have 3 months, then all of a sudden it gets kind of...
I don't know. Well, they make really good records over huge, long periods of time.
Yes.
I mean, they make TV specials about making those records and how long it took.
Yeah,
I don't understand it, frankly, but, you know, some people have a lot more, are a lot less ADD than me.
Is this a philosophy you take when you record music now?
With him.
What is that?
Well, with him, I know that he's, when I'm engineering for him, Randy, he's not going to do it 8 billion times. Like, for me, I might take 10 or 15 times, or just go nuts. But my headspace is okay where I can deal with that, and I don't get vibed out about it. Whereas with Randy, I know that he's going to do it and he's going to nail it, and me telling him to do it 15 times is not going to work. So I just stay at it, you know. I learned that. So, but he's good at what he does, right?
For the Ordinary Lives recording sessions, so the first group that we've done, that you're hearing the finished versions of some of that material, if we were going to do guitar solos or ad libs, I did all of them with the bed tracks. I didn't overdub any of them, and I didn't want to, because I don't want to do that anymore. because I did that. I had to do that in other situations, and it just wasn't any fun.
Yeah, so the solos, it's really quite remarkable. The solos that you hear are from the studio. It's what he did. And all the rhythm tracks, all of his rhythm tracks, pretty much, with the exception of some overdubs.
Interesting, because you take music that you had done previously, many years ago, and then brought it back.
Right.
And you just, so when you re-record it, do you take the exact same steps to reproduce it, or do you utilize technology?
It was pretty much the same way as this song that we're talking about, One Track Mind, the one you're going to play next.
Right.
It was written in the mid-80s. And I always thought it was kind of a timeless rock and roll song. It wasn't era specific in any way. And of the material that we were working on in the mid '80s, it was probably the least era specific song of a bunch of material that was done. And I played it in a few different venues. But it was done much the same way, where I had the riff, which is just a basic guitar riff. It's not exactly one you've heard before, but it's like ones that you've heard before.
That you
could sort of do right away. And what made the initial version interesting is in the pre-production for the recording of the song originally in 1985 or 86, a drummer named Daryl Burgess, who's a very famous drummer in Vancouver, who went down to Nashville and that was quite a successful studio musician and a songwriter in Nashville. So if you want to, Wikipedia Daryl Burgess, you can see all the country songs he's written. But the guy was a great drummer, and the part that he played after hearing the riff once was kind of the background that the song was built around. So I never played the Daryl Burgess version for the Ordinary Lies band. I just let them play it. And it's interesting because Lee Grant, our drummer, is a guy who was raised, there's generations of musicians, right? So Ross and drummers that come from Ross and my era, they're Ringo, Keith Moon, Charlie Watts, John Bonham. They're that, right? Lee comes from the Stuart Copeland era. So there's a completely different concept about where the beat is and where the one is and what the feel is. So we never even talked about it. So we kept that same guitar riff, and it was exactly the same way learning the song with these guys as it was in 1986. Is that your question? Was that sort of your question?
It certainly was, and that leads me to my next question. We talked about when we were playing the music before during the break. You teach a lot of guitar to kids.
Yeah. And adults. Lots of people in their, I have a fairly large clientele of like people in their mid, late 30s.
Someone comes to you, mm-hmm. I'm sure they have an idea of like what they want, they want to do Sweet Child of Mine or Welcome to the Jungle.
Yeah.
But what are the three songs that you think someone should know when they're learning guitar?
Well, you can't go wrong by putting on The Who live at Leeds and learning and just listening to Pete Townsend's guitar through the just kids, you go out and get that record right now and listen to the whole thing, because it is an absolute, it is the background to me of rock and roll guitar playing that's incorporated into traditional songwriting genres. So you have this guy who's playing really loud, basic, first position chords, but his knowledge of chord chemistry and his rhythmic ability is so fabulously evolved at whatever, however old he was then, 25 maybe, he was 24, 25 years old. So, and the way it was recorded, you have this huge guitar sound up front, and then you hear the slapback coming from the back of the university auditorium, like it would have been done here at Sub, right? It was that kind of a sub ballroom type gig, and I think if you listen to that, that's you'd be set. The other licks I think that are great are the bridge in Badge that George Harrison wrote for Eric Clapton. Copping solos, people always want to cop, the two solos in Hotel California, but you can get a whole lot more if you learn the original solo that Paul Kossoff played in All Right Now. Learn that note for note. just like this was like a 17-year-old kid, white British kid, came up with those notes. And then the other one that I sort of give young people that are learning to play and they want to be lead guitar players, to give them an idea of how to craft things, is Henry McCullough's solo in My Love, in the Paul McCartney tune. Because it's really simple, but it's amazing how he made those note choices. And then the other thing I would say is, go back to sort of the early Jeff Beck records. Because there was a guy who had all the sound was in his hands. And then just he created all those sounds just with his two hands.
Very well put. So shall we get on to...
Sure.
One Track Mind? The story behind this track? The story behind the lyrics, I should say.
I had a really good friend. His name was Mike. He was a sound man in Vancouver. He did sound for bands that I played in. He was originally from Wheat Ridge, Colorado, which is very close to the South Park guys. And even though he was considerably older than Trey Parker, Matt Stone, he had that same kind of sensibility. Like, he was that guy, but a half generation beforehand.
The dad, in other words.
Yeah, but he was like those kids. I mean, he was like, he'd grown up in this weird Colorado, you're like so close to the NATO bases, and there's just a weird kind of thing. And he had a really, really funny sort of look at top 40 bands, and it was such a different scene back then, top 40 bands and playing in a rock band and pretending to be like you're in an 80s hair band, and the women that you would meet, and sort of the interaction that would go on, or just these sort of mindless things. And he would remember sections that would happen at iconic nightclubs here in Vancouver. And one of his favorite ones was a girl had written something on a piece of paper and had put it on the bandstand or on the stage of one of these big Vancouver nightclubs. Because back in the olden days, there were all these big top 40 nightclubs where bands went and played covers with giant PA and light systems, like literally tens of thousands of dollars in 1970s show, and 1980s dollars to play, whatever the stuff of the day, to play Wings covers, and people would dance. And so this girl puts this note on the stage and lifts it, and the guy thinks it's a request, and he actually said, "You guys suck, unreal." Signed, everybody. So this was the kind of stuff he would remember. And the other thing was, people would get really drunk and they'd sort of walk around and they'd go up to a table of women and they'd say, "Do you want to dance?" And then the girl would kind of look at him, and then she'd keep looking and say, "Does she want to dance?" And that was sort of the inspiration for this tune.
Do you want to dance?
Does she want to dance?
Does he want to dance?
That's right. Smoke.
Here's Ordinary Lies, One Track Mind.
happening in here.
See the girl in the corner? Know the one over there? She must have worked for hours. The clothes she wears. I wonder if we think along the same lines. Cause tunnel vision could be the tide that dies. She wanna dance.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Seven Nines and Tens with Femke Jensen, named after the very famous actress from such movies as GoldenEye, X-Men, X-Men 2, X-Men United, and others. You're on Shameless on 119 FM, CITR. Some good news for them is just a couple days ago they were signed to post-rock slash experimental label Fluttery Records and are re-releasing this very record, Habitat 67. Sevens, Nines, and Tens have always been good friends of this year's show, so I'm very happy they have a home now. And I like to think they'd be celebrating pretty hard this Friday at their gig coming up at Funky Winkerbeans with the likes of Anchoress, Sabriel, and Prick Bastards. If you survived the show, you can tell your parents about it and your friends about it. Now I'm joined here with some rock legends. Ordinary Lies. How's it going, dude?
I just love the Femke Jensen reference. That's fantastic. Could have called the band Spring Byantine or it's a character actor from the 50s. No?
I don't know. I'm not that well read.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think you'd have to be well read.
I go narcoleptic when I start reading.
Well, you'd have to look at the credits of 50s movies to pull it. But I guess Femke Jensen is... What's Vera Farmiglia? You know that actor?
I don't think I do.
No, yeah, we do. I'm just pronouncing. I'm screwing up the pronunciation.
Okay.
I feel terrible. I feel shame.
Speaking of which, another track coming up later. I'll hype it up now. It is named G.G. Allen, and it's from a rapper from Toronto. Mm-hmm. I'll let that wet your palates for later.
Let that sink in.
We were talking a bit in the break about the change of music, the sound of music, how music has changed over the years. I do believe Habitat 67 from Seven, Nines, and Tens is the kind of record you can listen to, start to finish, in one long sitting, which is kind of rare these days, wouldn't you say, for a record to be enjoyed wholesale?
Yeah. I mean,
I think the album concept is not the norm anymore. Is that correct?
I believe it is on the way out.
Yeah, or is it coming back?
Well, some people say that
once it's on the way out, it's coming back.
Some people say that the albums are selling more on the providers, but I don't get it. You know, like, I still think, you know, singles. I mean, the model that we're using is more of a single kind of thing. Like, we put out singles, and that's what we do.
Right.
Could you foreseeably do a concept record?
If we had time and lots of money. And
probably not with a straight face, though.
Yeah, no.
No.
I was in a band, like I was thinking about it today, one of the hardest things to be in is a band that's, and be a writer is where you're constrained by what you're supposed to be writing. Like, I was in a ska band for years, and it was a great, great experience. But having to write ska music all the time was really difficult. And I can't work under that kind of thing. And same with this band, was that the idea was just to write music and then pick from the quantity that we wrote something that stuck together, not try and write a bunch of stuff that's going to sound the same, because it was really... I just can't do it. I just get claustrophobic.
It's a good example, because I couldn't imagine a ska record that you would listen to straight through and have it have the depths and the waves and the diversity.
Yeah, well, I mean, the ska records, the two big ones are, what was it, the Madness and the...
The Red Red Wine one?
Well, no, the Specials.
The Specials.
Red Wine was like way later, but the Specials, the first Specials, and which they did back up the Police when they came here,
right?
And Madness, and then but Madness couldn't stay in that genre. They ended up doing, you know, Our House in the Middle of the Street, which is not ska. It's about as far away, you know, it's not far away from ska. It's more quirky, but not ska.
Like Devo, Man Without Hat style quirky.
Yeah, quirky. Yeah.
Whereas Sublime keeps it real.
Yeah.
Or kept it real, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. One thing I've been dying to ask you, though. You've been pretty familiar with the Vancouver scene over the years. How do you feel that Vancouver has changed to you?
In terms of a music town?
Clubs to play in?
Yeah. Well, personally, I mean, I haven't been in the Vancouver music scene really since 1989. So that would be, you know, before a good portion of UBC students had been born. And I think Vancouver is an interesting place in that I don't think it ever I don't think it ever embraced its strengths. You know, I think there was some really... I think, in a way, the artists that were successful coming out of Vancouver were sort of in were promoted nationally and then internationally, sort of through the Bruce Allen talent agency and management, and they needed to have a commercial appeal that was going to be more universal in nature, and then you would have these occasional moves forward, such as The Odds. I think Craig Northey is probably one of Vancouver's richest resources, but I don't know if a lot of people would really know who he is or know his name. And I don't know if there's Craig Northeys now that are kind of the antithesis of Michael Bublé. Like, I don't know if that exists in terms of people that if they were able to get a wider audience, would certainly be able to maintain and make that audience grow. So I think Vancouver was a place that had lots and lots of talent and lots going on, but for some reason it didn't I don't want to come across like, you know, some sad old guy that says, "Oh, we just eat our own artists; we don't support them." Because I don't really feel that way. But there seemed to be something peripheral. There seemed to be maybe a lack of depth, and maybe that's because the city just grew so fast from being really small.
It's also where to play. I mean, and also, I mean, I'm totally politically incorrect by saying this, but the liquor laws killed it in a lot of ways. People going out to clubs. And it became really expensive. And also the price of booze became really expensive, where it's like $5-6 to buy a pint, whereas mm-hmm. back in those days it was not that expensive. The Cave was nuts, but something, you know, to go out for a drink back then wasn't that a lot
of
money.
I think the giant production nightclubs of the 80s, the 70s and 80s, were something that didn't happen as much in the rest of the world. So Toronto would have a whole bunch of music venues that would have original music and new music and all kinds of different kinds of music. And you wouldn't expect to have like concert style production. They just didn't have it. So there was a different expectation.
I feel like I've seen both the rapid expansion in short bursts and also this, I want to say, like a resistance scene that just bred out of there is no scene. We must try and make our own scene as often as possible. At least is my perception of Vancouver. Yeah.
It survives. Yeah. Life exists because it must, and it'll find a way.
And in the 60s, and I'm not from the 60s, so I just...
We were little kids.
I know guys who are from the 60s. Vancouver was more like an R&B or a funk town. You know, Paul Dean, who is the Loverboy guitarist and songwriter, and, you know, sometimes Loverboy would be used as an example of mainstream rock at its most formulaic, but Paul Dean was the guitar player in funk bands, and the guy's right hand was just, he's a machine. I mean, you know, he was a funky guy. From Winnipeg, but there, I think it was more of an R&B. You had Trials of Jason Hoover, even bands like the Seeds of Time when they were really young. It was still R&B based. It wasn't quite as three chord rock as, say, Seattle was. Yeah. Seattle was like really, you know, it was that Seattle garage sound, the Professor Longhair, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Dawn and the Good Times, you know, the Louie thing. Here in Vancouver, it was a little funkier.
Interesting.
This is just my opinion.
The show is nothing if not educational.
That's right.
That's what I strive for. So shall we get into some more tracks?
Sure. That would be great.
Ordinary Lies?
Yes, please. Yeah.
What are we going to hear next?
Did you put on Takeout, or is that what we're doing?
I did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is a good story, because... again, when I write lyrics, it's usually I sort of scat, and I'll scat a bunch of stuff, and then I try and figure out what the song is. Like, I don't really, half the time, I don't really know what I'm going to write about. So, and they usually comes out of my head. And this stuff is more or less East Side imagery from being a courier. I've worked on this East Side for years in the alleys and stuff like that. That's how I met. How I found Randy. I was sleeping in the alley.
This is not true.
It is true. Well, I was playing bass in the alley outside the church, and you came outside, and that's where I knew where he were. I was napping in my car, learning how to play bass again. And so the imagery is from the East Side. And then I wrote this song because we were trying to come up with a new song every week. And I wrote these lyrics, which were come for the. It's a good. I'm going
to. Yeah, no, that's, you don't have to justify yourself. Go ahead.
I wrote this chorus, which was, in all due respect, it was lame. Randy was right. It was like, I think it was like, "I belong to you." That's what the chorus went. And Randy said, "You know, everything else is good, but do people really write choruses like this anymore?" That was the exact words that you said, and he indicated Miley Cyrus or something like this. And so, like, here I went, oh, fuck, here we go again. And so he went away, and I wrote the chorus. And the chorus was just a bunch of, again, scat stuff, but I didn't want to change it. And I said, "Well, here, you don't like this chorus, do you like this chorus?" And this is the chorus that you get to hear in this one.
Changes in my life plan. I left my mattress in the rain. I don't know where I stand. I told a thousand lies before till you sat by my side. And now I'm gone a million miles. They're going to place I'm running by. Pink bow tie, I don't care. Solitude sucks so bad. So I'm tongue-tied on the phone. It's better than being sad. I never thought that in my life I'd spend the night in jail. But that is bringing me to your door without me ever leaving. Here's a little song with your side of fries and a big trombone for your suicide. We have a slingshot ride that is also wild. We have a Jacob. The same old show. Seen it 10 times, so you think I know. I'm lying in a pool of blood. Metaphorically speaking, you can call it love. Summertime is not so fun, especially when you're gone. I walk 100 miles of road to camp upon your sleeping bone. Here's a little song with your side of fries and a big trombone. Suicide, we have a slingshot ride that is also wild. We have a Jacob.
Alright, here's where we get really scary. Suicide, we have a slingshot ride that is also wild. We have a takeout. Here's a little song with your side of fries and a big trombone for your suicide. We have a takeout. Here's a little song with your side of fries and a big trombone for your suicide. We have a
mama, sing me a lullaby. Do you believe?
We want Gigi. We want Gigi.
I got my pencil sharpened, homeboy. Rap music. Half asleep in an alley, feeling dope sick. Walk nose bloody, hobo hungry. Torso chubby, walking John Goodman's footprints. Lied to by every crystal ball I've ever looked in. Matt and Ruby Bush, they're the basement of the Alamo. The laughing stock of the talent show.
Jones.
January, Jason Sudeikis. Wait, the Alamo don't got no nigga for them basement. Pee-wee, the Buxtons are not thieves. But do you ever dream? Yeah, I'm all alone. I'm rolling a big donut in the snake wearing a vest. Then I wake up in an alley feeling dope sick. Deja vu, a sewer rat spewing raps. Spewing last night's dinner on my shoes and pants. Picking at a tattoo scab of the Kool-Aid man. Hallucinating, fuck it, I'm alright though. Walking the boulevard of broken dreams. Last resorting to the quotes of preachers, nuns, popes and priests. But in the end it's just little old me. A nobody with a notepad trying to find a voice to speak. So tell it like it is, homeboy. Yo, I ain't scared of you, but I'm further. No, build a bridge to burn it down to the ground. And we don't need no water, let the motherfucker burn. Burn, motherfucker, burn, burn. It's our turn, motherfuckers. Creep show, riot in the streets. Death to the dream seller. Yeah, nobody wants to hear the fat boy whine. They just wanna hear the frat boy rhyme. Feeling safe and cuddled up with what frat boy writes. But frat boy sucks and the fat boy's nice. Renegade rebel tagging lies on a newspaper box. Fuckin' the system, but the first to run away from cops. Fuck the mainstream, they scream. Fuck that East Loaf sound. Fuck that music Justin makes for his East Loaf crowd. But that East Loaf crowd's pissed. Beaver's getting East Loaf now. Sending death threats, so tell me who's the East Loaf now? Middle class boy. Boys who think pop punk is friggin' rad, or middle class girls who love Glee and silly bands. Writers ask me what I think of the state of hip-hop in Canada, and I tell them I don't. I'm sorry if I don't think about rap in Stouffville. I'm busy trying to get rap to pay my phone bill. I'm in my own world, you don't have to move in. But I got a couple guest rooms. So bake a pie, eat a pie, take a side. You can fight me in this war, or you can fly beside me to the stars and I'm gone. So tell it like it is, homeboy. Yo, I ain't scared of you, but I'm further. No, build a bridge to burn it down to the ground. And we don't need no water, let the motherfucker burn. Burn, motherfucker, burn, burn. It's our turn, motherfuckers. Creep show, riot in the streets, death to the dream seller.
G.G. Allen.
Sometimes I find a track, and the name is so intriguing, I just gotta give it a listen. And that is Toronto's Decisive, sounding a little more crunk than I expect from him, from his latest record, new to the CITR library, Run With The Creeps. The track, G.G. Allen, named after a very interesting figure from rock music from back in the day. A man I've only heard stories about, I'll say that much. And none of them were good. Vancouver's Humans before that, and they'll be playing with Blood Diamonds at the Biltmore this Friday. Last time you can see them before they head down to the iconic South by Southwest Festival. And we started the set off with Ordinary Lies, who are here with me in the studio right now for the next 15 minutes.
Woo. Wow.
It's been a hell of a ride.
Yeah, it was me this morning.
Hope you two have had fun.
We did. Awesome. Thank you for having us, John. Totally. It was nice.
Coffee's coursing through my veins, as it is required.
It's a good feeling.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you, though, before you head out, we were talking a bit about the radio business, being in the radio business. I know you've had some experience in the radio business so far.
Yeah.
I know you've answered this already, but I found your answer quite interesting. And being in, you know, radio myself, hell, you know, ever somewhat professionally, somewhat not. How do you find listening to radio while also having been in radio? Does it drive you nuts?
It doesn't drive me nuts. I haven't worked in radio for, 16, 17 years is a long time. And a few years ago, I made the decision that I wasn't gonna run a car all the time. That my wife would have a car and she would run the car, then I wouldn't. I would take transit and I would try to work around not having a car. And I found that when you don't have a car anymore, you don't listen to the radio. Yeah. And as I'm, you know, from a different generation, it's not my first. It's not the first thing I think about doing to download podcasts or radio shows. So I don't do that. So my radio listening has basically ceased. But if I am in a situation where I've rented a car or I'm in a car that has Sirius radio, I'll mostly listen to something like the stand-up comedy stations. Or I'll listen to all sports stations. And it's not even that I'm keenly interested in the sports that they're talking about. I'm more interested in the rhythm of the presentation. Because for me personally, my roots in radio go back to when I was a little kid and my dad was a big old-time radio fan. So I was very familiar with radio shows of the 40s and 50s. And I would listen to those in... they'd either be on cassette tapes or CKNW would play old-time radio shows. And I became very interested in talk radio. And I actually worked in talk radio for a few years, so as a kid. But music-wise, I'll just one anecdote about back when I was in junior high school. There, we weren't connected. I mean, it was very unusual for 13, 14-year-olds to buy music publications. Like, you wouldn't buy NME. There, you might buy 16, but that was really more for teenage girls and was more looking at heartthrobs. You know,
it's about the articles somewhere. It's about the articles.
The articles. So we weren't really connected. So we didn't really know what was coming out. So I remember, you know, doing math homework in my bedroom in 1971 and hearing Won't Get Fooled Again come on the radio for the first time on what was then called, I think it was CKLG-FM, and hearing a lot of Who's Next, and it was just amazing. That was an amazing experience. And the same within that time period where there wasn't a lot of exposure to R&B, but you'd get to hear Motown records on the radio. And that probably wasn't somewhere that I would gravitate to because, you know, demographically, Vancouver may have had pockets, but that wasn't, like, if you're back east, you'd be way more aware of African American music and African American music culture. So those are sort of my radio memories. And when I did radio, it was personality. The idea was that it was personality driven. We wanted to entertain people while they were driving to work.
And I find this very interesting. I know people listen find it interesting too, because like nowadays everyone's really segregated to what they like. CITR especially, you know, it has its fans. They want to hear a certain style presentation that's not private and popular style, personality driven, could say. Personally, I find it very interesting. All styles of radio are very interesting. And I always wondered if I could ever like chat with someone who did radio professionally. Like, I know you did a morning show for a while. What was it like? Like the execution, the style, like what did you do? How did you prepare?
How did I prepare?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there certainly was prep involved. You would get up, usually got about 4:30 in the morning. You'd get into the station about 5 or 5:15, and there would be, I would look through the news of the day, because you would have the news person and the sports person, of course, that come in, and you'd make fun of them. And you wouldn't make fun of the news per se, but you would create that character of the on-air, the iconoclastic on-air person. So you'd need to be familiar with the material, just so it wasn't like you were going to write the quips or the ad-libs, but you needed to be familiar with the material because it would just give you that little extra edge. We would look through, see like who in the rock and roll business was having a birthday that day, what was released. We would look to see if there were news items that would be of local interest, but at the same time were available or appropriate for lampooning purposes, and those would be made as a list as well. If we were continuing any kind of an ongoing or a serial program of things that we were doing, we would want to take that to the next point. So there was a structure, and there was preparation involved, but you could certainly get good enough at it where you wouldn't have to do that. And because I worked with a partner, the partner would operate, would do what you're doing now, and so his attention was somewhat distracted, so I was able to do whatever, using the word nuance for morning radio on a mainstream rock station seems a little bit hyperbolic, but it was
all the nuance of a sledgehammer.
Yeah, right. But it was, but I try, you know, we tried to, you know, have some class and dignity. No, we didn't. Making that up. That's not true. But so there definitely was prep involved, and there are technical things. There's things that I'm sure that you're working on in your mechanics, in terms of intakes of breath, how you're going to phrase things.
Personally.
Yeah. You just don't breathe?
My breath for
that's a good way.
15 minutes at a time.
I think another thing, too, is just sort of, you know, do the Craig Ferguson thing. You just think about what you're going to say, and the audience just has to glean it through, you know, some osmotic process.
And try and discern that Scottish accent of his.
And what a day for that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A bonny day, you could say. That's Irish, isn't
as
it?
I. Oh, no, darn.
Sorry. Well, in these twilight hours of the show, there's one last track of Ordinary Lives.
Oh yeah, to play. And you gotta ask Ross about this song. This is a great song.
Hmm. Okay, Aunt Mary is the title.
Aunt Mary. It came up from a riff as usual, but I was thinking originally about the line about the gin and the stuff was like right from the very start, And I really liked what was going on, and it took a long time to get to that point. And then I did this thing one night, and I met this person, and they talked about their stuff. I have a bit of a drinking history, and so anyway, her story was related to me, and one late night, and I didn't really know what I was doing there, and then I kind of wrote about it, And with the good thing about it in the song, the woman doesn't recover. The other person who's in the song it's kind of like basically he's deciding whether to leave that relationship. It's not a relationship. It's more of like a older person, younger person. It's like Aunt Mary, and he decides that he's going over there, and it's the last time. But he does get, you know, wasted or whatever, and he leaves her. And that's what the song is basically about, the guts to leave a bad situation and walk away from it. The only other thing is that of interest is I have certain, I don't know if I should talk about it, but I do have certain, sometimes I get certain depressions and stuff like that. And I actually had, when I sang the lyrics to this song, I'd been working on working up to the vocal to get the vocal done. And then one day I was going through one of these things and I decided today's the day. And so that's, so basically, you're hearing it.
So, do you think Aunt Mary's a personification of alcohol dependence?
Pretty much, yeah.
So it's a metaphor type of thing.
Yeah, dependence, codependence. Yeah.
Well, and the other interesting thing is that we had a band in 1983 that we were in together, and the band was called Sensible Shoes, with John Cody and David Reimer, who have long histories in Vancouver rock. And John Cody is married to Lee Aaron, who is and Dave and John both play in her band and do lots of other music stuff. And when Ross and I talked about doing this project again, they were sort of, we talked to them about doing it, but the band was called Sensible Shoes. So Ross actually used the phrase Sensible Shoes in the song, and we It was the time when the Wilco album came out with the song Wilco on it, and we sort of thought about the fact that we had that Ross had worked the name of the band into the lyrics of this tune, but subsequently we didn't use that name.
Yeah, because somebody else had it.
Curses! It did me wonder where the name Ordinary Lies had come from.
That was another thing. I was writing a song and I was going through. It was coming up with Ordinary Lies, and Randy liked the name Ordinary Lies for a title of the song, and I had come out with. Going between Ordinary Lies and Ordinary Lives and Ordinary Guy. And I went to the art gallery one day. It was a surrealistic exhibition. I just sat there and I looked at these surrealistic paintings, and I was trying to come up with lyrics for Ordinary Lies because that was the decided title of the song. But I couldn't come up with anything because I didn't want to write about making fun of normal life and suburban life and all this other stuff. It was some road that had already gone down, and I just thought that's a better name for a band than it is, and I'll change the name to the. We haven't written the song yet. We've written the song, but it hasn't been done yet. So that's how we, and then we decided to go with Ordinary Lies. And that's how we did it, because we'd already gone through this for 6 months. Do you like this name? Drain plug something. Drain plug. I forget. There's a whole pile of other ones.
I really liked Relentlessly Earnest, yeah. But the guys we play with are from Surrey, and they didn't appreciate the whimsy.
Yeah,
and I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah,
I think they're probably wise.
It was passed. Relentlessly Earnest was passed as being a good. It was given the stamp as being okay.
It's a great series of movies too.
Was that a movie?
Jim Varney's
yes, work. Yeah. I didn't even think of that concept, but that part. But that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Oh no worries.
Thanks for having us, John.
Ordinary Lies. How can people find you online?
We have a website. It's pretty thin, but you know it's www.ordinarylies.ca.
Yeah. It's ordinarylies.ca. Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. Here it is, Aunt Mary. This is you. Mm. Stay tuned for Folk Oasis. CITR.
But the sun rose and the war was raging. this is not